We see now that no, we have not motivated the South Vietnamese army, and that foreigners cannot go to South Vietnam and motivate anybody. Remember the history of Vietnam. They were part of the Chinese Empire for nearly 1,000 years, and they won their freedom. And they fought the French in a war of independence for 7 years, and they won at a place called Dien Bien Phu. And we have been fighting them since 1961. And they have not won, but they have not lost, and they have held their own against a very rich and a very powerful nation whose weapons of destruction are truly something that none of us, because we are sane, can possibly imagine. The different types of bombs, and the napalm, and the white phosphorus, and the gases, all are beyond the imagination of people who are eminently sane. So, the morale of the South Vietnamese army is bad, and the number of deserters is increasing. And I have seen the South Vietnamese army in action. And I would never say to you that the Vietnamese are cowards, that when they believe in something, they will not, as will all men and all women, stand and risk their lives. But the war had no meaning for them. The war had no meaning for many of them. Communism is our word. We know what communism means to us. We see life in the Soviet Union, and we see life in Poland, and we see life in Hungary, but the word does not have the same meaning for them. They have different words. And I think what they most want is to be left alone, is to go back to their villages, is to lead quiet lives, and probably have as little to do with their government as possible. The Vietnamese have always been most suspicious of government on the national level. For years and years and years, the Vietnamese have had village chiefs, and some sort of balance has been worked out in the village. Who takes the decisions? Who enforces them? Who agrees? There was a curious balance, difficult for us to understand. And not for a second would I say that life was perfect for Vietnamese peasants before 1960. It was not, but it was better. One of the things that most distresses me in Vietnam is it is hard for Westerners who are mobile, because which one of us, if we were given a house, a car, a mover, couldn't go from here to California, couldn't move to Florida? But what the Americans never understood in South Vietnam is the Vietnamese are not mobile. You must not take them off their land. You must not separate them from their graves. In Vietnam, a Vietnamese worships and loves his family, living and dead. And the tombs of his ancestors are in the rice fields, an honor. In Vietnam, you say in Vietnamese to a man, not how are you, have you eaten your rice today? Rice is more than food. Rice is their emotional gravity. Rice is their life, their blood, their children, and their family. And what the Americans did, perhaps because they saw no alternative, and I am not a Clausewitz or a military expert, was they took villages in areas that they suspected were infiltrated by the Viet Cong, or villages that had been sympathetic to the Viet Cong, and they took them, as I take this pack of cigarettes, 6,000, 4,000, 3,000, and they moved them so they could bomb the area. But by moving them, they made of them what the Vietnamese are not, a helpless people and a begging people. They made of them refugees. And because they had made them refugees, for they had taken them away from their fruit trees, from their orchards, from their lands, from their rice paddies, we then had to have programs to feed the refugees. And I remember in many camps talking to American officers who were running the camps and saying, God damn it, these dinks, they keep going back to the land. But of course, they're wired to their land. They are wired to those tombs. How can a man stay alive in Vietnam as a refugee inside a huge, hot American army tent. And they tried all the time to go back to their land. And what difference did it make to them if a unit of Viet Cong soldiers came through at night and taxed them and asked for rice and asked for salt, and we came the next day and interrogated them? They have to be near the land. And I have met men who were half a mile away from where their land was and who talked as though they were men who had been raised in Budapest and suddenly found themselves in Chicago. So great was that distance, half a mile. And I hope if peace ever comes to Vietnam, they can go back. And I think what's difficult for us to remember is, with our very clear idea of communism, anti-communism, with our knowledge of the history of Europe, that in some villages in Vietnam, the men who went off, and the women, to fight in the National Liberation Front are not despised. They are looked upon with far more respect than the Vietnamese in the village who went to work for the American army and became their whores and pimps and cooks and shoeshine boys. I don't believe that peace is very close, because I am so very cynical and suspicious, and I don't really have any direct telephone line to the Oval Room. In fact, I am quite sure I will never be allowed in the White House for the rest of my life. I will just give you briefly my impressions, and then perhaps we can have a question and answer period. I feel in many ways that the United States has reneged on Mr. Kissinger's original agreement. If there are to be free elections someday in Vietnam, and the police and the 1 million men in the army of President Nguyen Van Thieu are in place all throughout that countryside, how can there be free elections? I mean, I was hoping some of you could explain this to me. If the Vietnamese people are at last to decide their own destiny, and they are at last to be able to go and vote for which government they prefer, it seems to me that they must do so with other people standing around than the soldiers of the Saigon government. And it can be said that one reason for leaving North Vietnamese troops in place, although that is not a solution either, is to protect those enclaves where people would be free to vote for the National Liberation Front. I would ask you to be remembered of 1954 and the Geneva Accords, which the United States did not sign, but which the United States pledged to observe and not to obstruct, and how there were plans for an election in Vietnam in 1956. The first year I was in Vietnam, and the United States ambassador told me that the South Vietnamese had been persuaded not to hold these elections because it would not be in their interest, and that President Eisenhower in his biography said, if elections had been held in Vietnam in 1956, 80% of the country would have voted for Ho Chi Minh. And you know, I do know officers in the Army of the Republic of South Vietnam who are deeply anti-communist, who are members of the Roman Catholic Church, who also look upon Ho Chi Minh as not a communist, but a great nationalist leader. And I think this may be hard for us to understand. But to go back to the peace talks, the principle of whether the North Vietnamese troops stay or go is at stake. The restoration of the DMZ is at stake. The North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front feel that Vietnam is one country. It is not two countries. It was divided by the Geneva Accords at the 17th parallel. This is a temporary demarcation line, not a frontier. To restore the DMZ is to again cut the country in half. And the other issue at stake is the composition and power of this three-part National Council of Concord and Reconciliation, which is supposed to, after a ceasefire, set up the apparatus for free elections. Since Dr. Kissinger spoke to us on television, there has been considerable discussion that he has either been most deceptive or that indeed he agreed to the 9-point draft ceasefire and then met a great deal of opposition in Washington from President Nixon. I am so suspicious, I'm inclined to believe he has consciously deceived us and spoke to us on television and said peace was at hand, knowing very well that there would be a reversal of our position. We had agreed to these 9 points, and we are now reversing our stand on a considerable number of them. There is also, and I bring this up only for you to consider, the opinion in Washington that what is going on now between Washington and Saigon is just a ballet, just theatrics, that we have always known that President Win Van Thieu, of course, would protest, and we have suddenly become very refined. You know as well as I do that we could say to Win Van Thieu, shut up, we put you in power, we have kept you in power, we are close to peace, we are not going to listen to you. This is not the legitimate government of Saigon. And suddenly, the objections of President Win Van Thieu have become very important and are stopping us, ostensibly, from signing the peace treaty. There is the point of view that we knew all the time that this was going to happen, and we have encouraged him to protest, and that we will eventually work out an agreement, but we will then be able to turn to some of the more conservative members of Congress and say, look, you see, we gave in on this, 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 and we've done this, this, this. And all the time, we knew we were not going to sign. But as I said, I don't have a direct line to the White House. Dr. Kissinger has not called me, as he so frequently calls members of the New York Times Bureau in Washington to advise them what stories they should write. And they usually write them. And one must, I think, always be suspicious of Washington reporters. I simply don't know. But I think we should sign. And I think that the Vietnamese should then have the right to work out their own destiny. I don't think they ever will. I don't think that we'll ever give up the American presence in Vietnam. I mean, many people that I've talked to throughout the country think that the war is over, and you and I know better, and as our friend down there pointed out, the air war has been worse for the Vietnamese and the Cambodians and the Laotians than when 500,000 American ground troops were there. And this is one of the great tragic realizations for friends of mine in the anti-war movement, that they disposed of Lyndon Johnson in order to put Richard Nixon into office, and that while the ground troops are out, the great horrible realization is, and some of you know this better than I do, and those of you who've been working for peace for 8-9 years, that the war is now worse. For they are not only bombing in the north, but heavy bombing is going on in the south. And the bombing in Cambodia is quite unbelievable. And the bombing in Laos will shortly make of that country nothing but connecting craters. And so I think what I have advised other groups to do who are interested in working for peace, and what I do myself, is simply approach individual congressmen, especially those of a more conservative nature, and try to bring all the pressure to bear on them. For fool yourself not, people who are interested in ending the war have remarkably little leverage, and we are a vastly outnumbered group. But it's nice to know that we are not entirely alone, and I'm glad to have come here today. And if you have any questions, because this was a very jumpy speech, I'll be very glad to answer them. Thank you.
Like he just moved up to the old woman and started nudging her. And then I saw her fall out of the way when the convoy had completely passed. Like she was on the road, really like squashed.
How many Was it a large convoy?
No, it was about five trucks, maybe six.
Five or six trucks. Did anybody stop from the convoy and
No, shoot? They kept moving. They were loaded.
They kept moving. Also, did you ever see the mistreatment of prisoners that we had taken, Viet Cong suspects or NVA?
Yes, I did. These people were only suspects taken from a village after we had a minesweep team that was wiped out. And I guess people more or less went out to pick up these suspects on a grudge basis. When they brought them back in, they were loading them into a truck to take them to Hoi An. And they were making a game out of it by grabbing their feet and their hands and swinging them up in the air and see how high they could throw them and land in the back of a deuce and a half truck, which has a steel bed.
Okay. Were there any say senior NCOs present or officers?
There was a staff sergeant present.
Staff sergeant. That's a staff NCO.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Mr. Olimpieri, I wish you could... there's some testimony here of you witnessed a 7-year-old man wounded near about 20 miles southwest of Da Nang. Could you elaborate on this, please?
Yeah. We were in a sweep in a rice paddy, and the flank man spotted somebody and told him to halt, and he started running. And I fired an M79 over the trees, and it went off, and the man went down. And we went over to... our lieutenant told us to go over there and check and see if he had an ID and find out if he was dead or what was happening with him. We went over there, and he was still alive. He was about 70 years old. I believe he was some sort of religious, like a monk or something like that, from his dress. He had an ID card, and he was in pretty bad shape, so they didn't want to call in a medevac chopper, so they told us to kill him. And the person who did the killing fired about six rounds at him, and I had to tell him to stop. And right after that, they called in. We told the lieutenant what the situation was, and he called in and said, get rid of the, he told us to get rid of the ID card before we killed him. And he called in one VC body count.
So this man that was killed wasn't even a suspect.
Right,
he was a civilian.
Right, he didn't halt when he was told, so they shot him.
Mr. Nenke, I understand you were in the same unit with Mr. Olimpieri. Were you present when this happened?
Yes, Paul Olimpieri was my squad leader, and I was in the same squad.
All right, so you can, in fact, substantiate this. He did tell somebody, the person who did the shooting, to stop afterward?
Correct.
Okay.
When you did take POWs, were they tortured, or what was the procedure if you did take prisoners?
We took a lot of prisoners. Some of them were suspected VC or NVA, and they were usually brought to the compound when we took prisoners and turned over to an interpreter, usually either a South Vietnamese or Korean interpreter, and if the information couldn't be extracted from them, they were tortured and sent back to the CP, or the command post.
What type of torture were used, would you know?
Well, we were basically on the lines. We could hear screaming, and I didn't see any torture, but we could hear screaming, and somebody was being beaten.
Mr. Sachs, you testified that there was prisoners thrown out of a helicopter. Could you tell, elaborate on that subject?
Yeah, this was one of the big games, was whenever any prisoners were taken, the crewmen in the helicopters, who were in charge also of loading, in addition to maintenance on the aircraft, would blindfold the prisoners, holding the blindfold on with heavy wire, safety wire. They'd bind their hands, bind their feet, maybe bind them into a fetal position. And upon landing, rather than releasing them so they could walk off the aircraft, they'd throw them out, get the grunts to mark how far they could throw them, and they'd have little contests. This was done with officers observing up, at least all company grade officers. There may have been a major prison too. The general attitude of the officers was, I was the lieutenant at the time, well, there's somebody senior to me here, and I guess if this was an SOP, he'd be doing something to stop it. And since nobody senior ever did anything to stop it, the policy was promulgated, and everybody assumed that this was what was right. We'd never had any instruction in the Geneva Convention. When we were given our Geneva Convention cards, the lecture consisted of, if you're taken prisoner, all you gotta do is give them your name, rank, serial number, and date of birth. Here's your Geneva Convention cards, go get them, Marines. We were never told anything about the way to treat prisoners, if we were the capturers rather than the captee. And this was very standard.
WBAI New York.
Mr. DeLay, on your testimony on the 24th of December, 1969, 25 people were killed. Could you elaborate on this subject?
Christmas Eve, shortly before midnight, a platoon from India Company, a group of Marines from India Company, had set up an ambush in Arizona Territory, and they killed 25 people. To my knowledge, it was never determined whether they were civilians or were in fact the enemy, but in examining the bodies, they discovered one weapon. It was a 9mm pistol. The next day, on Christmas Day, the battalion commander sent an order all about the battalion area, Hill 37, requesting any enemy weapons that were in the hands of individual Marines. A friend of mine from Delaware, Jim Raymond, had bought an AK-47 from another Marine when he came into country. I was ordered to take this weapon down to the command bunker and give it to Major Martin, the executive officer of 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. When I gave this to him, he gave it to another Marine and told him to go smear some mud on it. There were several other weapons acquired in this manner, and they were all sent into regimental headquarters as being captured Christmas Eve with those bodies to make it appear as it was, to make the group of people appear to be a heavily armed enemy force.
All right, do you remember if there was a Christmas truce announced at that time?
Yes, there was.
So it could be said that, at least on this level, that the Christmas truce was broken?
Yes.
All right. Mr. Camille, you were in artillery. You were artillery FO. You were attached to the 1st Battalion, 12th Marines.
I was in the 1st Battalion, 11th Marines.
Excuse me.
Attached to the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines.
All right.
You have some testimony here on the burning of villages, cutting off of ears, cutting off of heads, calling artillery on villages for games, women raped, napalm on villages, all sorts of testimony of crimes against the civilians. Could you go into just a few of these to let the people know how you treat the Vietnamese civilians?
All right. The calling in of artillery for games, the way it was worked would be the mortar forward observers would call in, or we'd pick out certain houses in villages, friendly villages, and the mortar forward observers would call in mortars until they destroyed that house. And then the artillery forward observer would call in artillery until he destroyed another house. And whoever used the least amount of artillery, they won. And then when we got back, someone would have to buy someone else beers. And the cutting off of heads on Operation Stone, there was a lieutenant colonel there, and two people had their heads cut off and put on stakes and stuck in the middle of the field. And we were notified that there were press covering the operation and that we couldn't do that anymore. Before we went out on the operation, we were told not to waste our heat tablets on food, but to save them for the villages because we were going to destroy all the villages. And we didn't give the people any time to get out of the villages. We just went in and burned them. And if people were in the villages yelling and screaming, we didn't help them. We just burned the houses as we went.
Why did you use the heat tabs? Did you just light off the villages with matches, or did you plant the heat tabs, just throw the heat tabs in so it would keep burning?
Well, we throw the heat tabs in because it was quicker, and they keep burning. They couldn't put the heat tabs out. We throw them on top of the houses. People cut off ears, and when they'd come back in off of an operation, other people, you'd make deals before you'd go out. And like, for every ear you cut off, someone would buy you two beers. So people cut off ears. The torturing of prisoners was done with beatings. And I saw one case where there were two prisoners, and one prisoner was staked out on the ground, and he was cut open while he was alive. And part of his insides were cutting out. And they told the other prisoner, if he didn't tell them what they wanted to know, that they would kill him. And I don't know what he said because he spoke in Vietnamese, but then they killed him after that anyway.
Were these primarily civilians, or do you believe that they were, or do you know that they were actual...
If you killed someone, they said, how do you know he's a VC? The general reply would be, he's dead. And that was sufficient. Women, when we went through the villages and searched people, the women would have all their clothes taken off, and the men would use their penises to probe them to make sure they didn't have anything hidden anywhere. And this was raping, but it was done as searching.
As searching, were there officers present there?
Yes, there were.
Was this on a company level?
Company level.
The company commander was around when this happened. Did he approve of it, or did he look the other way, or?
He never said not to, or never said anything about it. What the main thing was, if an operation was covered by the press, there were certain things we weren't supposed to do. But if there was no press there, it was okay. I saw one case where a woman was shot by a sniper, one of our snipers. And when we got up to her, she was asking for water. And the lieutenant said to kill her. So they ripped off her clothes. They stabbed her in both breasts. They spread her eagle and shoved an E-tool up her vagina in a trenching tool. And she was still asking for water. And then they took that out and they used a tree limb. And then she was shot.
Okay. Did the men in the... In your outfit, or when you witnessed these things, did they seem to think that the it was all right to do anything to the Vietnamese?
It wasn't like they were humans. Like we were, you know, we were conditioned to believe that, you know, this was for the good of the nation, the good of our country, and anything we did was okay. And like when you shot someone, you didn't think you were shooting a human. They were a gook or a commie, and it was okay. And anything you did to them was okay because like they would tell you, well, they would do it to you if they had the chance.
Right. This was told to you all through your training then.
Definitely.
Boot camp and advanced training and so forth, and it was followed on then.
Definitely.
Right on through it. Okay, Mr. Campbell, you were in the same... I believe the same unit that Mr. Camille was. There was a period of perhaps 2 months separating the time that he left and the time you came. Was this same unit type policy, was this carried on?
Some of the policy was not carried on because of an incident that happened in Quang Tri province that Scott Camille witnessed. And there was a big stink about it. There was some kind of investigation into it. And I heard about it when I got to Nam, and all the guys that were there before me talked about it. And things were kind of cooled down, so a lot of this stuff, when I first got there, wasn't carried out. Bravo Company was to cool it for a while, the whole battalion, actually, because we had a bad mark against us from the incident previous to the time I got there.
All right, one more question on that. The training, what did you consider the Vietnamese? Were they equal with you, or?
The Vietnamese were gooks. They were all, we didn't just call the VC or the NVA gooks. They were all Vietnamese were gooks, and they were slant eyes, zips. They were Orientals, and they were inferior to us. So we were Americans. We were the civilized people, and you know, we didn't give a shit about those people.